Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In an interview yesterday with WOSU's Tom Borgerding, Ohio's senior U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown said that Libyan intervention gives him pause and reinforces his view that the U.S. not overextend its military obligations in the region. Let's listen.
I note all this with caution. I think that this really reiterates to me that we need to get out of Afghanistan starting in July, as the president had said. Whatever happens in Libya has to be short term. We should not commit ground troops. All of that concerns me.
Today we're going to talk about concern over President Obama's decision to begin bombing in Libya to protect civilians. Later on we'll hear from a local organizer who supports U.S. involvement in Libya. Joining us now is The Nation Managing Editor Roan Carey. Roan, welcome to the show.
Good to be on.
Also, Peter Mansour. Colonel Mansour is General Raymond E. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State University, a position he assumed after a 26-year career in the U.S. Army that culminated in his service in Iraq as the executive officer to General David Petraeus during the period of the surge in 2007 and 2008. Welcome to the show, Colonel.
Great to be on again, Ann.
So, there are a lot of mixed feelings about this in the United States. People feel good about saving Libyans from being slaughtered. We always feel good about something like that. But not everybody feels 100% about what the ramifications might be down the road. What are your thoughts about that, Roan? You had an editorial starting last week that kind of equivocated a little bit.
Well, we acknowledged, first of all, that there was a serious danger that Gaddafi would carry out massacres if he seized Benghazi, and he had made threats, hair-raising threats, about house-to-house searches, and he's demonstrated over many years that he's irrational, and his repression of unarmed protesters was severe, and he extended those repressions. So there were genuine fears about what Gaddafi would do. Also, there are positive things to say about the way the Obama administration approached this. They were very reluctant to do so. Secretary of Defense Gates raised some very penetrating questions about complications if America got too deeply involved. The Obama administration quite correctly noted America's past involvement in the Middle East, most of those involvements being very negative, and said we really shouldn't take the lead on this. He was reluctant to do so, and he insisted on following correct international procedure through the United Nations Security Council. All that was done. So in that respect, I think the Obama administration has been correctly cautious, even as it has acknowledged that the people of Libya were desperate and were horribly oppressed by Gaddafi's.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't obviate all of the serious questions about what this intervention is for, what it's going to lead to, what the end game is, and commentators from all over the spectrum, left and right, mm-hmm. have raised very serious questions about it, and we at The Nation were doing so as well. We're quite skeptical that this has been really thought through very carefully.
And on top of everything, Colonel Mansour, NATO is bickering about who takes the lead and who does what over there.
Well, exactly. And I would agree that this hasn't been thought through very carefully. And once again, we're seeing that the United States is the indispensable nation with the best military capabilities to pull something like this off. But we don't want to really be in charge because we don't, once again, want to have Arabs say that we're in it just to steal Libyan oil and so forth. So we need international backing. We would like the French or the British to take the lead in leading the operation. Even beyond that, we need to step back and take a look at what are our objectives and, what is the strategy to achieve them, because I think it's pretty fuzzy and unclear at this point.
I guess one bomber went down, the two airmen they were rescued. But what happens militarily when we might, if and when we lose people like that and they're taken captive? What's the protocol in those kind of cases with something like this?
Well, they should be treated as prisoners of war, and we would expect Gaddafi and his forces to adhere to the Geneva Conventions. Whether that happens or not remains to be seen.
But this isn't an actual war, right, Roan? And there's questions about that in Congress, about whether Congress ought to be approving any more actions.
Well, that is the question. Is it a war or not?
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting very serious disagreement about it. Many people in Congress, from Dennis Kucinich on the left to people on the right, like Dick Lugar, are saying that Obama has overstepped his bounds, that he has to get congressional approval. People have talked about the War Powers Resolution, which itself is interesting because the War Powers Resolution, that's the 1973 law that was passed in the wake of Vietnam, stipulates that a president, if he engages military forces, he has to notify Congress within 48 hours. And then he has a period of anywhere from 60 to 90 days to withdraw or to cease his military actions unless Congress gives approval. So there's, you know, an open question as to whether Obama was legitimately following U.S. law in engaging his forces. But certainly that question is going to keep on if, you know, this gets messier.
We're talking about the concerns over U.S. involvement in Libya. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. To our listeners, do you think we ought to be over there at all? Or should there be some form of relief but not military relief? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. My guests, retired Colonel Peter Mansour, he's the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at OSU, and also The Nation Managing Editor Roan Carey. How far, at this point, is it too late anyway, Colonel Mansour? Is it too late? Top rebel officials say the internationally enforced no-fly zone has come too late to alter the equation on the ground. They say their forces are not equipped, no matter what, to battle Gaddafi's superior arsenal.
Well, I beg to differ. I think the no-fly zone has already made a difference, mainly because it's not just a no-fly zone, but aircraft have also hit tanks and artillery outside of Benghazi, turning the tide of the battle there. So, but the issue beyond that is the rebels cannot, and I do not believe they cannot, topple Gaddafi without significant assistance and a great deal of time from the West, arming them, training them, all of which takes time. So what you're going to have probably is a period of stalemate, mainly because Gaddafi is not going to give up. President Obama has already declared that he has to go. Well, that doesn't give Gaddafi any reason to negotiate. And so what we have here in the United States and in the West is an objective that's you know, regime change, if you will, with very limited means to accomplish it. A no-fly zone, sanctions, diplomacy, maybe arming the rebels. And so you have a disconnect between the ends of policy and the ways and means that we have chosen to achieve it.
Roan Carey, Elliot Abrams in an online debate said that perhaps the president should not have said these things and should have said, this is not our fight. We have nothing at stake and we aren't getting involved, but that he did not. He took sides in the first place and that this was inevitable once he took sides.
Well, I think there's some of this reminds me of the intervention in Somalia by the senior President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, back in 1992. In some ways, this was at the very end of his presidency, you'll remember. It was after Clinton had been elected, but before Clinton took office. There was a lot of pressure from the international community and from the public in the United States to do something about the horrible humanitarian situation in Somalia, so he did. And then we know from history how that led to mission creep and a disaster under the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
But just to go back to what this mission is in Libya, there are some really serious contradictions. If you look at the UN Security Council resolution that authorized this, first of all, it was to protect civilians, and it was also to establish a ceasefire. Now, what's interesting is that the rebels have insisted from the beginning to end that they will not follow a ceasefire, that they're going to keep attacking. So that raises the question, well, if the United States and allied forces like Britain and France are going to help the rebels if they're going to directly give them arms or indirectly encourage supply of arms. In a way, they will be abandoning the UN Security Council resolution. So that's one contradiction. And the other contradiction is that, the ceasefire is, they're not really pushing for a ceasefire. And Mr. Mansour raised the other one, which is that the Security Council resolution is purely about humanitarian aid, not about ousting Gaddafi. And yet the national goals of the Obama administration are about ousting Gaddafi. You saw also these internal contradictions in the British political system when Prime Minister David Cameron, when he was asked, he said, oh, yes, it's perfectly appropriate for us to oust Gaddafi. And his chief of staff, his military chief of staff, said, no, it's not. We're not permitted to go after Gaddafi. So there's all these disagreements, contradictions, uncertainties about what to do.
We have an email from Charlotte in Columbus. She says, war is a tool to implement policy. It cannot substitute for a policy. What is the policy? If our august leaders think that they have found a convenient payback opportunity to rid the world of Gaddafi, then once again they have failed to line up credible allies to replace him in a traditional society ruled by blood ties and clan loyalties, not abstract notions of a modern nation state or the secular rule of law, which does beg the question, I guess, that's the right phrase, Colonel Mansour. Who are the rebels? Do we even know?
Well, you know, I love that email. I mean, I think the she hit it right on the mark. We don't know who the rebels are. You know, they talk a good game about democracy, but, you know, democracy in that part of the world isn't necessarily as stable a system as it is in this country because it lacks a civil compact to support it. Libya is a highly tribalized society, 140 or so tribes. It doesn't have a strong civil society because Gaddafi has quashed it over the last 30 years. And I think what we're likely to see is a period of stalemate here. Gaddafi, with the U.S. and Western allies backing the rebels, Gaddafi can't defeat them, but the rebels can't defeat Gaddafi either. And this is likely to devolve into a very nasty insurgency. Yet again, we'll be involved in one of those conflicts and for very unclear goals, supporting people we don't really know a lot about.
Ron?
I agree with that. That's a problem. As best we can tell about the rebels, the Transitional National Council, I believe it's called, it's headquartered in Benghazi. Mm-hmm. It seems to be mostly composed of civil society figures, lawyers, businessmen, ordinary citizens who are just outraged and fed up with Gaddafi's repression. But it doesn't seem to have a very clear leadership structure. It doesn't seem to extend its writ even beyond Benghazi. It seems to be completely disorganized. As a military force, it's laughable. There's absolutely no training, no command and control. It's basically just a lot of young men who are quite excited and, you know, but undisciplined, and they can't really engage Gaddafi's forces. So I think Mr. Mansour was right. I think we're headed for a long-term problem. It doesn't seem to be to admit of a quick solution. There was some hope at the beginning that just the UN resolution and the international intervention would encourage some of Gaddafi's own better trained forces to defect and join the rebels and lead to a quick turnaround, but that does not seem to be happening. So we're in for a stalemate.
We have to take a break right now. My guests, Peter Mansour and Roan Curry, will return when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Eric French. We have a chance of showers and thunderstorms today with a high reaching 55 degrees. More showers likely tonight, up with a possible thunderstorm reaching down to 50. And the same for tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms, high of 66.
On Talk of the Nation, we tackle the day's issues and discuss the topics that matter to you. We take the time to explore every angle of a story, and we do it all live with your help. Find out what everyone is talking about. I'm Neil Conan. Tune in and join the conversation next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Join us from 2 till 4 today for Talk of the Nation on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about U.S. bombing in Libya as part of an allied force in support of a U.N. Security Council resolution. Where might it lead us? How far do we want to go? Joining us is The Nation Managing Editor, Roan Carey. Welcome again, Roan, to the show.
Good to be on.
And also retired Colonel Peter Mansour. Peter is the General Raymond E. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at OSU. And that's a position he assumed after a 26-year career in the U.S. Army, and it culminated with his service in Iraq as the executive officer to General David Petraeus during the surge in 2007-2008. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned a little bit, Roan, you started to bring up the issue of engaging the military in Libya to defect, perhaps. That was part of the success in Egypt?
It was. There, though, it was a very, very different social, political, cultural situation. The army in Egypt is powerful, well-organized, disciplined, hierarchical, with a very clear structure, and the army is all pervasive in Egyptian society, and the army did decide, once the army's decision not to support Mubarak, it was decisive. And Libya is quite different because the army is strangely weak in Libya by design. Gaddafi, in order to prevent military opposition to his dictatorship, kept purposely a weak army and armed battalions of, you know, presidential protection forces that were mostly run by family members. So it was kind of divide and conquer strategy on Gaddafi's part.
So the sharpest tools in the toolbox aren't necessarily running the army then.
No.
Is that do you have the same sense, Peter?
Well, there's one other difference, though. Roan correctly characterized the impact of the army on Egyptian society. But the other thing is that U.S. military officers in the United States military has a very close and intimate connection with the Egyptian military. We've been arming them to the tune of $7 billion a year since the Camp David Accords in 1978. We train Egyptian military officers in our military schools here in the United States, and it gives us a great deal of influence with their officer corps. That's completely lacking in Libya. And I think really what the administration is using as a model for the campaign in Libya is Kosovo. If we just bomb for a while, the other side will give up, and then we'll achieve our goals without any sort of ground force involvement and a minimum of bloodshed. I think it's a bad model, but I think that's the one that they're using.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, gentlemen. I had a question. It's sort of a little bit off topic, but overall, the question that I was wondering is that it seems like the history of our country and the way it's been is we'll go into a particular area, whether it be Korea, when we are at war with Germany and all these other different countries, it seems like upon, you know, victory being resolved or anything, then we leave a certain amount of the military presence behind. At the rate that we're going, it seems like we've got our military scattered all over the world. And, you know, post-Cold War, post all of these different conflicts, I'm just wondering, I mean, at some point, are we going to stop leaving our military scattered all around the world so we have a presence everywhere when we have aircraft carriers and all the other different means to be able to deploy troops and certain place? I mean, I'm just wondering, now are we going to now leave troops over in these countries now? And it just seems like we're kind of overextending.
Bottom line is, can we afford this?
Well, I think he raises a very important question. We now know that there are massive budget deficits in the United States, and there are cries from the right wing, especially in Congress, that we do something about the budget deficit, but there hasn't been nearly enough talk about the Pentagon and defense spending, which is at record high. And we have hundreds of military bases around the world, as the listener correctly pointed out, and we're vastly overextended in Iraq and Afghanistan already. And I think it just reason demands that we make serious cuts to this. And we can do so without threatening American security, because we have we spend more on the military than all other countries in the world combined. I mean, it's a staggering total. But there's another question about this, which is about the contradictions of American policy. The listener pointed out that we have bases elsewhere. Well, this intervention in Libya is supposedly for humanitarian purposes, to protect civilians oppressed by a dictator. But at the same time, we're giving massive military aid to Bahrain in the Persian Gulf mm-hmm. and to Saudi Arabia. And both of those governments are repressive autocracies which have savagely repressed peaceful demonstrations and demands for democracy. So you have to ask, okay, we are supporting a population fighting for democracy in Libya, but we are supporting a dictator, dictators in the Persian Gulf who are repressing the same demands. Why this contradiction in U.S. policy?
But that's not the first time the U.S. policy's contradicted itself. In the,
oh, no.
You know, so that's nothing new.
No.
Peter, thoughts?
Well, yeah, I agree about the contradictions in U.S. policy, and I can't quite get it in my mind why we want to see Gaddafi go, other than he's a bad guy and he's, you know, potentially, I would think the best reason is his involvement in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and the Lockerbie massacre. That would actually make more money than sort of the nebulous goals of supporting democracy in a place that lacks any sort of ability to support it. On whether we're going to leave forces behind in Libya, though, I really don't think we're going to put ground forces into the country, and our air bases are in Sicily and other places, so I don't think there's going to be a U.S. presence in Libya. The better question is what sort of international presence will be cobbled together to put Humpty Dumpty back together again once Libyan government is destroyed.
What about
What we saw in Iraq is that takes a lot of effort to build a government from scratch, and here we are doing it again.
What about the idea that this effort could be pushing him back into the arms of terrorists or have him embrace terrorism all the more?
Well, again, what we've done is we've created a very total objective of regime change, and Gaddafi, like Saddam Hussein, isn't going to go quietly. So he'll do everything in his power to make it very difficult for us to achieve that objective and then to make it very costly should we do so. And he's got means to support terrorism. He's got WMD. He's got all sorts of things that he can use. And those are the fears now that we've backed him into a corner. And so here we are.
Ken in Columbus, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to ask, you know, Mike, whether we're right now in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Pakistan is not real stable, and it's a nuclear country. In Afghanistan, we won't really know whether we've been successful or not until the summer, when fighting will start again. So my feeling is Afghanistan to America, it's more important to seize Afghanistan than in Libya, because Afghanistan, because of terrorism, and the fact if we don't succeed, what that means, what it means to Pakistan. And the question is, you know, the French have been the one behind this, it seems, and now the French doesn't want NATO to go in, so we don't know where France actually stands on this. And you know, I believe it's a stalemate, and that America should work to bring the two sides together in a peaceful manner. So that's, I'd like to get your commentaries, opinion on that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ken.
Well, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, that's okay, Ron.
Well, those are two very different questions. With respect to Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think he's right that these are major crises, and I think the United States is in a very deep hole there for several reasons. Chief among them is that the government that we're supporting in Afghanistan has no legitimacy, deeply corrupt, and does not extend its power even to all of Kabul. The Taliban are quite powerful and control huge parts of the country, and it's very difficult to see how that's going to change between now and the summer in a significant way. I think the best the U.S. can hope for is a withdrawal and some sort of agreement, ideally multilateral agreement with all the players in the region, whereby the Taliban might be able to take part in a new power structure, but they would agree not to harbor al-Qaeda-type jihadis. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the best the U.S. can do. Pakistan is absolutely, he's correct, it's a powder keg. The U.S. has been carrying out all sorts of covert operations inside Pakistan that are deeply resented by the population there. And at the same time, the military in Pakistan, who we've been giving billions to over a period of many years, has been covertly aiding the Taliban in Afghanistan, who we are fighting. So it's a whole series of crazy contradictions in South Asia that our government's involved in, and I don't see an easy way out for the Obama administration. With respect to France and Libya, yes, it's true France was pushing this, and I think a lot of that was cynical motivation. France felt very embarrassed and humiliated when the demonstration first arose in Tunisia back in December and January. The French government backed the Tunisian dictator, and they were made to look awful, and the entire Arab world was condemning France. So now France is trying to make up for that by doing all it can to support the popular resistance in Libya. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy behind Sarkozy's policy. But be that as it may, the fact is that France and Britain have been the ones who've been pushing this the most, mm-hmm. and I think the U.S. has correctly taken a back seat to that. But as Mr. Mansour has pointed out, only the United States military has the unique capabilities to do things like pinpoint attack on surface-to-air missile batteries, all the sorts of things that we do with cruise missiles that the British and French aren't quite as good at.
Well, the other thing, Ann, mm-hmm. about France is they were the first ones to recognize the rebels as the legitimate government of Libya. It backed Sarkozy into a corner. He had to support some sort of military action, but now that we're in, he seems to be waffling a bit. So there's a lot of diplomacy to play out here in the future as well.
We have an email from a listener. They write, as someone who's old enough to remember the photographs from Rwanda of bodies clogging rivers like a log jam, I support this effort in Libya, and I support any effort ever made to stop the slaughter of civilians. It's far too early to call this a quagmire, and I wish people would withhold judgment and stop prognosticating failure at this very early date. Too much of our partisan politics are coming out about this. We've made mistakes in the past when it comes to doing nothing but condemning out of hand, particularly in the face of barbarity. An effort to protect civilians seems unconscionable to me. And the reason why I wanted to get to this email with both of you right now is that is partisan politics playing much of a role at this point?
Actually, I don't think so. You have people on both the left and the right supporting intervention, and people on both the left and the right opposing it. I don't think it's necessarily playing partisan politics to ask for a clear objective and a clear strategy to achieve that objective. And I just don't think that if our objective is to is a humanitarian one, that what we're doing right now in basically making creating a situation where this war can drag on for an extended term is necessarily conducive to the achievement of that objective.
I agree with Paul. I think, whenever you have Dennis Kucinich and Rand Paul and Dick Lugar in Congress all raising very similar questions, you have to acknowledge that, criticism and questions are coming from all over the spectrum, and I think it's healthy. I think we need that.
Either that or one of the seven signs of the apocalypse.
So.
I wanted to get to a few more emails. Well, why don't we take Tom from Circleville? You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding, Turkey's kind of upset because they weren't informed about what was going on. I could be confused about that. But I believe that they should hand everything off to the French and the country of Turkey because that is in their area. They are also NATO. And I don't understand why Turkey was not involved in this. And my last comment is it's all about the oil, and I'll take my answer off here.
Okay. Is it all about the oil, and why isn't Turkey involved?
Well, I can talk about the oil. Libya is the 18th largest producer of oil in the world. It produces maybe about 3% of the world's oil. But the world's oil markets had already self-corrected for the loss of Libyan oil. So I don't really think this is about oil at all, but more about perhaps in some cases national prestige. If you look at the French, there is a humanitarian impulse, no doubt, on the part of the West. Other people just don't like Gaddafi, but, you know, that's, I think, an insufficient reason to topple him. But, you know, like in Iraq, I really don't think oil is the root cause of why we took this action.
Ron, any thoughts?
I agree. I don't think oil was a primary motivation. Obviously, everybody was thinking about it, and it's important to acknowledge that oil Libyan oil is very significant in certain countries, Italy in particular. Italy is dependent for a huge percentage of its oil from Libya. But Italy joined as supporting the coalition. And I do think, I agree that this is more about national prestige. It's about answering to the public clamor for the potential for massacres. With respect to that question about Turkey, well, it's interesting. Turkey opposed this intervention. Turkey has been against it. And in fact, when there have been recent discussions about handing over responsibility to NATO, Turkey said, no, we should not do that. And Turkey is a member of NATO, and Turkey has complicated that effort to turn this into a NATO responsibility.
We have another email from Robert Sr. He says, thanks for having this topic. Let's remember what dictator Gaddafi did to the world, including killing U.S. servicemen in Germany and Pan Am 103 and others. Gaddafi, in his daily seven-hour speeches, has said as soon as he liberates Libya, he will be settling scores with the West. Comment, please.
Well, I would agree that if you look at his past misdeeds, and if you said, okay, this is an opportunity to get back at him for what he's done in the past, for his role in Pan Am 103 and so forth, that to me would be a fairly legitimate national security objective, but we haven't talked about that at all. The president talks about humanitarian impulse. He talks about getting rid of Gaddafi, but he hasn't linked it to any sort of reason, in my mind, that would bring the public along with him, other than that, oh, he's a bad guy and therefore he needs to go. But we could say that about probably 100 countries around the world.
That's true, and also there's a huge contradiction just with recent Western involvement with Gaddafi, because in the last 5-6 years, most European countries, in particular Britain and France and the United States, they had a rapprochement with Gaddafi, and they were starting to deal more closely with him and were starting to improve relations. When the U.S. was satisfied that Gaddafi had ended his nuclear program, they patched up relations with him. They didn't seem to mind that he was a dictator who repressed his people and was also crazy to boot. The same was true for Britain and other countries in Europe. So actually, Western powers were quite happy with Gaddafi in power in Libya in the last 6-7 years. Before that, they were, of course, there was tremendous conflict, and Reagan, you know, had a brief little skirmish back in the 1980s, and then there was, of course, the Lockerbie bombing, and there were attempts to get rid of him then. But in the past few years, actually, the West had been quite friendly with him. So this is a huge turnaround.
That is all the time we have for our guests. I want to thank retired Colonel Peter Mansour. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Ann.
And also the Nation Managing Editor, Roan Carey. Roan, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Ann. It was good to be on.
Thank you. When we return, we will be joined by a local activist from Libya who now lives in the United States, and talk to him about what folks in Columbus are talking about regarding our action in Libya. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how pizza, pasta, and olive oil came to America. Food writer John Mariani talks about his new book, How Italian Food Conquered the World. Mariani is also the author of the Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink, and he writes about food for Esquire magazine. Join us.
And Fresh Air is at noon, following All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Eric French. Today we have a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high to reach 55 degrees, cooling down to 50 tonight, more showers likely, and a possible thunderstorm. Showers and thunderstorms again tomorrow with a high of 66 degrees.
State Auto Insurance has supported the quality programming on WOSU Public Media for over 30 years and is now proud to support the Columbus Neighborhoods Project. For many years, it was a thriving neighborhood, the commercial and cultural center of Columbus's African-American community. Thousands who can trace their roots there still consider it home, despite problems such as unemployment, abandoned houses, and vacant stores. And many say it's poised for a remarkable comeback. Watch Columbus Neighborhood's King Lincoln, airing Tuesday, April 19th at 9 p.m., only on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to All Sides. Joining us now is local businessman Hamdi Salaman. Hamdi was born and raised in Libya and has been actively speaking against the Gaddafi regime since he was 12 years old. He moved to the United States in 1981 to attend high school and college and was granted political asylum here in the mid-80s. He did not return to Libya until 2008, and he returned again in 2009, and he made his latest visit there in January. We welcome him back to the show. Welcome back, Hamdi.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be back on the show.
So you've heard a lot of concerns. That was sort of the focus of the first two segments of the show. It's not unusual. There are some out there encouraging these efforts by NATO, by the United States and Libya, but there are also a lot of concerns. Do you have any concerns at this point?
Well, first, I want to take this opportunity on behalf of the Libyan people, and that's actually people that I have talked to from inside and my family, that I want to thank the international world and specifically the United States for coming to the Libyan people's rescue. The no-fly zone, the attacks on Gaddafi's army and his military bases are very much welcomed. The hits are 100% accurate. All the targets are 100% accurate.
So far.
So far, with very minimal casualty. You know, the concern whenever you have war, whenever you have a fight and war, that's always concern because you know some civilian lives and innocent life would be killed. So nobody's for that. But you know, the Libyan people had no choice but to ask for this because Gaddafi was killing them, regardless of. What the world community was saying. So we had no choice to ask for the help. And then as far as the Libyan people, not the rubble, because those are average people. Those are average people, housewives, kids, college kids, people that are in the street. They just want to get rid of Gaddafi, you know. And they had the desire, they had the heart. They didn't have a lot of weapons. And like Mr. Rohn spoke a few minutes ago, the Libyan army did not have a lot of training. It was just like a ghost army, if you would.
It could cut both ways. It could make things easier or more difficult because they don't have that strength, political strength in Libya that, say, they did in Egypt, and therefore they don't have the relations with military in the United States.
And then Gaddafi has kept the army basically like a ghost for a specific reason. He had a close army closer to him because he did not trust anybody. Mm-hmm. He did not trust anybody. So that was done for a reason. But, you know, the revolution in Libya started on February 17th. It started by the people, and the people that are doing it now, it's going to be finished by the Libyan people. All what the Libyan people were asking the world is just to keep the scale balanced because Gaddafi was bombing them with the airplanes, was bombing them with the tanks, and the people could not succeed and go toward the west of Tripoli, where Gaddafi is very strong, to fight him because he was showering them with the airplanes. He was showering them and killing them. So they just wanted to make the fight even, you know. I know with some of the – a few of your guests earlier, they were saying, what does the America has to do with it? Well, Gaddafi has American blood on his hands. You know, I mean, we should never forget that. He has the lives of the people in Lockerbie that should never go to waste. You know, that should never go unanswered. But because, like I said on my previous attend, a lot of the governments, the Western government, specifically the U.S., they were taking interest over principles. And then, you know, a lot of people asking, why is the United States, what do we have to do, you know? Why are we fighting all the way in Libya? We have no interest in Libya, but we have interest in humanity. We have we support the freedom. The United States supported the freedom. President Obama's big speech in Cairo was kind of encouraging people in that region, you know, to uprise and to stand up for freedom. So, and as the promoter of the freedom, and then for the free speech in the world, we have to protect those rights. Otherwise, Gaddafi will come back on us here.
I go back to the issue of no civilian deaths yet that have been caused by the bombing, by the U.S. bombing in Libya. What happens? I mean, where's the tipping point for the United States and NATO if and when people besides the Libyan military start to get hurt and killed?
Well,
how much are they going to put up with, really?
Whatever casualty will happen from the NATO, from the coalition forces, is going to be a lot less than what Gaddafi will inflict. Gaddafi has said, you know, once he prevail, he's going to go house by house, street by street, and basically kill everybody that opposed him. Just last Saturday, before the bombing started, he had his agents or some of his mercenary in Benghazi, the city of Benghazi, and they were sniping people. You know, within a matter of last couple of hours, there were over 100 people were shot. You know, so it's, you know, I mean, like I said, I know, you know, there's a price to freedom, and the Libyan people feel that, and they know that you have to pay a price. Freedom is not going to come peacefully, and then we're willing to pay that price of the casualties.
Michael from Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
And thank you very much. Excellent show. First the experts, and then actual eyes and ears, or at least through telephone on the ground. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a comment and then a question for your guest. The comment is just, thinking back to what the expert said, you know, if the far right and the far left are representative, and of course John McCain, who thinks we didn't go in quickly enough, if those two are in agreement, then I'm going with the 70% in the middle that are pro this. And really, I advise people to listen to what Negroponte said on NPR on Morning Edition. He's certainly no liberal, and he thinks it was right. Now, the question to your guest is, one of the reasons I support it is because of the wonderful guests you've had, people talking about what people want in Libya, what the actual people on the ground, the people whose families are still there. How do we, you know, since the point was made that Gaddafi was making moves towards the West that were good, that is, stopping his nuclear program, how do we guarantee that the wrong rebels don't get the advantage of this no-fly zone and fight back? How do we have enough people here, relatives and Libyan expatriates, who can give us the inside information that can tell us that the right people are ascending to power?
And
that's it.
Who's going to govern? I mean, who would govern? And how do you avoid the turmoil?
The Libyan people will, you know, it would be a democratic country. It would be a democratic government that would be chosen by the people and for the people. You know, we do not like that word rebel, because a rebel is, you know, like what happened in South America, where you have people that are actually trained fighters that are opposing the government. These are individual, ordinary people that are uprising, and they had enough of Gaddafi, 42 years of oppressed, you know.
But how do you avoid, how do you know that whatever replaces him is going to be better, and that somebody who might be organized might take over? And
Because the revolutionary starts from the bottom, from the heart of the people. It's everybody in Libya is, you know, the majority, 99.9% of the Libyan people want this. You know, so everybody's going to make sure that nothing happened but the freedom and the right to speak and the freedom to live. And Libya will contribute to the West. You know.
What about the military, though? Who will? There aren't enough defections.
Well, we talked about that as far as in Egypt,
was a big issue.
You know,
here,
when you're thinking of a military in Libya, there's not really, I mean, the best way to describe it, there's two militaries. There's the what's so-called military, and then Gaddafi's guards or the close close circles, you know. And then, as you could see, all in the east of Libya, from Misrata on back, you know, a lot of the military have defected to the people, but they don't have nothing. They don't have no weapons to fight.
Right.
You know, they do not. You know, so that would give you a real good example of you know, the military is the people in Libya, because everybody in the military is not like in here where you have the draft where you voluntarily go to the military. In Libya are people that are forced to go into the military. You have, like I in my case when I was there in junior high and high school, we were forced to go to the military, and then even if I stayed, I would still be in the military forcefully.
In Libya, and Michael, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
In Libya, people like you who have left, would you go back? Do you know people who would go back and try to help rebuild? Because the fact is he has been in power for 41, 42 years, and the ability to govern is a learned thing. It's not an innate trait.
Yeah, a lot of people have fled Libya, you know, under Gaddafi, you know, and then a lot of us in the West, there's over a million people in the West, you know, Libyan people that have a lot of education, higher education. We have a lot of experience. You know, we learn from the West. So, yeah, we're going to rebuild Libya. Myself, I'm not necessarily might go back as far as to live, but I'll go back and contribute. And there's a lot of us that will contribute. There's some of the best surgeons in the world are Libyan. Some of the best business people in Libya and in the world are Libyan. So we like what we lived in. We like what we lived in. We like what we have here in the States. And we want to just make sure our people have the same right and have the same opportunity to live the same way we live here.
John from Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank your guest. I heard on MSNBC last night on Rachel Maddow's show, Richard Engel, who reports for MSNBC, he said that the rebels can be divided into two groups. As your guest has already said, the ex-military, disenchanted ex-military, who, of course, you know how to load a weapon and so on. And the other group was conspiracy-minded individuals who have no military experience. He said in some cases they did not even know how to load a rifle or load a armament of any sort, and also had conspiracy ideas that Gaddafi might be Jewish. I was wondering if you had any insight on what Engel was getting at.
Well, on your question as far as the military, the people who defected from the military, Gaddafi, he's so evil, he's so deceiving to people that a lot of the some of the military people that to keep him under his gun, he's detaining his people, he's detaining their family, their loved one, so they know that you. You can't do anything. You know, if you do something, then your family will be killed or imprisoned. I mean, that's how Gaddafi is. In the last few weeks, a lot of those bodies that you've seen, they were bombed by Gaddafi. The families were not allowed to take their loved one so they could bury him. They were kept by the government. And all of that's been documented. They were kept by the government. And then that's what you see a lot on the TV. That's what you see that when they were showing Saturday night, a lot of the bodies that you know supposedly killed by the bombing. If you see all of those bodies are covered, they all are buffed up and exposed. You know their stomach and so forth. So you can see that if you just pay real good attention to those pictures. As far as like his background or you know there's rumors that you know that he's. He's related to, his mother is a Jewish, but that's beside the point. I mean, that's not what we're here for. You know, the struggle of the Libyan, when you believe in a dream, when you believe in something for all this long, you know, for this long, you know, then the people will prevail. The people will prevail, and then we'll carry that on, you know, all the way through.
John, what was the point when you're saying that someone was talking about a conspiracy theory? I'm not quite sure I understood what you mean by whether or not Gaddafi's Jewish or not.
Well, from what I can tell, he was explaining that the rebels were divided into the two groups, and the one group was sort of a fringe, kind of offbeat group that believed in quote-unquote, I don't know if he said this exactly, but wild conspiracy theories.
Okay.
And that's what he was saying, that they didn't even know how to load their rifles. And I was wondering how significant that portion of the rebel resistance is compared with the ex-military.
Well, that would be the same. Like if you have people in Marysville, you know, expect them to to load up assault rifle and drive tanks, you know.
Yes,
same thing
right.
in Libya. Those are just people, ordinary people. My family, my brothers, and my nephews are the same people that are fighting on the street. They're just fed up. They're just fed up. And then they're learning. They're learning their way. And then what they have on their side is, you know, is the belief that, you know, this man has to go. This man has to go. And then he has not only hurt the Libyan people, but he hurt the whole world. He hurt the whole world. And then he hurt the American people as well. You know?
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Let's hear we don't have time to hear the clip now, but Sherrod Brown, our senior U.S. senator from Ohio, says that Gaddafi's removal can only be done with broad support from Arab nations and from Europe, but Arab nations in particular. Do you agree or disagree? Are you getting the kind of support you think you ought to be getting?
Well, we're getting a little bit of support, but you got to understand.
Right, it seems like only a little. Most
of the Arab nation are like Gaddafi. Other, you know, most of them are dictatorship like Gaddafi. You know, like what's going on in Yemen.
Authoritarian, right?
Yeah, and then so they're all come to power by force. So if they come to aid to Gaddafi, other than few countries, then basically they're encouraging people to uprise against them. So kind of like, you know, the double sword knife. If they help Libya, then pretty soon they're going to have the same problem in their countries, you know. Go ahead.
Well, no, I'm just wondering about the Arab world and its support, and ultimately...
And then there's help coming from the Arab world. Qatar and Bahrain is helping. Egypt is doing a great service to the Libyan people, bringing a lot of aids in. Tunisia is doing opening their borders for a lot of the aids in. You know, so there's help from the Arab country coming in. You know.
We had a caller, Omar. He said he heard a report that Gaddafi's son, Khamis,
yeah,
was killed by Libyan kamikaze pilots. Any idea if that's true? Have you heard anything? Is that a rumor?
It's a very, very strong rumor, but it's not confirmed because, again, everything that Gaddafi does is under tight lip. So definitely there was, when the plane went, you know, when the pilot went into the Gaddafi's compound, some high-level official went to the hospital. They kind of surrounded the hospital. So that's been floating around for a couple of days. You know.
If Gaddafi were to be captured, where do you think he should be taken? Should it be left in Libya to be dealt with by the Libyan people, or taken away?
Well, you know, there is the ICC, the International Criminal Court. You know, mm-hmm. they have to investigate Gaddafi. Gaddafi has a lot of blood on his hand, not only Libyan, but Americans, Britain. So
Pan Am. Mm-hmm.
Pan Am. So, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, he's going to be answering to a lot of people. But, yeah, definitely the Libyan people. And he's going to, you know, and surprising to him, he'll get a fair trial, too. So.
Well, I want to thank you, Hamdi Salaman. Hamdi, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
We will no doubt return to this conversation. So thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.